Hi, this is Chris, and welcome to Foundations in Social Innovation. This podcast is being recorded on Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and emerging. So well done. You've made it this far. And as we come to the last few modules of FinZee, I'll be attempting to spin some new threads of learning from the modules that we've already covered. This module is all about systematizing social innovation, and it's going to wrap together everything we've learned about social innovation and everything we've learned about systems. We'll be asking the question about the conditions that are needed to make social innovation possible and help, maybe even to make it mainstream. What would it take to make social innovation the default approach when it comes to making meaningful progress on obstinate social challenges? This is going to be an episode that zooms out to look at the big picture, that zooms in to look at our inner world, and travels forward in time to imagine what the world would be like if we adopted social innovation. So you last met my son, Frank, when he was 6, and in the module about prototyping and systems. But now it's 2031, he's 18, and his new little brother, Ivor, well, he'd be 10.
Hi, I'm Frank, and I'm 18.
Hi, I'm Ivor, and I'm 7.
And what's even more exciting is that in 2031 is that social innovation has become mainstream in South Australia, where we live, and mainstream in the lives of my boys. After all, social innovation is about creating a better world to live in. And in 2031, between the heat waves and the floods, that sounds like a pretty smart thing to be thinking about to most people. Ivor is coming to the last years of primary school, and I like to think that social issues and the possibility to change the world and to live in different ways, maybe even change things as arcane as the education system, are taught at school, as is innovation with the social purpose function. And maybe after school he doesn't go to play soccer, but instead goes to some kind of super fun and social and intellectual and active social innovation club, where kids get to meet kids from all backgrounds, where they play games that encourage them to reimagine the world, and where they do a range of transformative community work, the kind of stuff that's going to help the transition to a more regenerative way of living. Well, they learn about power and politics and about the injustices experienced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, but also build their appreciation for the systemic and sustainable nature of first knowledges. And all of that's fun and energising, and he comes home exhausted from it in a good way and dying to go back the next week. And Frank? Well, I think in 2031, he'd be choosing his next step in his education and career. Maybe his interest in mental health is shifting from thinking about becoming a psychologist to getting into mental health innovation and innovation for well-being more generally, because that's become something you can actually study now. Maybe he chooses a course that's a combination of part university, part placement in a community mental health service, and part taught by people with living expertise of mental illness and people leading change in their own towns around mental well-being. And injustice is still very much alive in South Australia, but we have made some meaningful progress since the introduction of citizen assemblies and participatory budgeting forums that set the agenda for social programs, allocate funds and report on progress in ways that people and even politicians can understand. Because now in South Australia, for stewardship on the most complex issues, government turns to these new expert bodies that last longer than a government does, that make both values and based decisions and are informed by the science of what works and what doesn't. And in 2030, South Australia is still the festival state. So, of course, there's a festival, the Festival of Living, that every year celebrates the progress made on issues like climate change, health, and Aboriginal representation in the state. It's a place where new ideas for the future are discussed, where the social innovation clubs hold their annual games, and where the next rounds of funding for social R&D are announced by the citizens' assemblies. Aging social innovators like me, who by now are well past their sell-by date, While there's now a rich set of social innovation jobs, even in this relatively small state, there are jobs working for community groups who have organised to become the people who set the agenda in their towns, as well as for not-for-profit organisations, a number of which specialise in developing new models of practice and services and spreading those across Australia and overseas. Or there's always joining the growing network of social fiction writers who spend their time imagining alternative ways of living. Today, there are glimpses of all of these things in Australia, even if for one or two of them, the glimpse is on a dusty post-it note on a long-forgotten taxi mirror board. All these things are certainly plausible, and I think they're preferable. And right now, we might even be on the verge of a set of broader trends that create a tipping point for social innovation in Australia and the world over. Creating the conditions for social innovation at four scales of system. The inner level, the conditions inside of ourselves and our colleagues. At the organisational level, the conditions that we create inside our organisations to do social innovation work. We'll look at the level of institutions and infrastructure and what's often called the system. But beyond that, we'll also touch on the societal and cultural level. In some ways, it's these broad societal movements that would underpin everything else we're going to explore here. Creating them is going to be a long path to travel, but it's one that our social R&D action area at Taxi is already on. I spoke to my mum last night. She's in Wales, old South Wales, and she was on her way to get her COVID injection, first dose. And Jeff talked about that amazing world scientific system that has been put into action around developing these vaccines in ultra-fast time. And that's because there are systems in place to discover new knowledge, to share new knowledge, for scientists to collaborate in different ways, approval processes for drugs to get approval for human usage, delivery, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, they've existed for nearly 100 years. They've been legislated for nearly 100 years in pharmaceuticals industries.
This is a rare excerpt from an actual in-person conference in Queensland in February 2021.
When NASA was tasked with getting a man to the moon and back again, it created this quite interesting stage-gated process to work through all of the innovations that worked, identify the ones that didn't. Exactly as Carolyn was saying from Griffith, direct the money to the ones that worked, and in the end they got there and back in 10 years. And it's a very similar kind of process that people like Elon Musk are using today in the sort of new space pioneers, and quite those quite visible what look like failures of rockets exploding nearly every week are part of that experimentation process, of course. And we have it in things like agriculture. So the eggs you made this morning may have been ate this morning may well have been influenced by the work of the Egg Development Corporation in Australia, or the wine you had last night by Wine Australia, or your breakfast cereals by the Grains Research and Development Corporation. These are sort of part of 16 rural research and development corporations, part funded by government, part by industry, that in part look at coordinating research and development activities on things like mangoes or avocados. Critical stuff. But this is quite different from the approach to research and development we have in the social sector, and that's what we wanted to talk about. And there's two concepts, if we're talking about social research and development and R&D, there's R&D processes. I'm not going to talk about that too much today, but there has been some great thinking done by Social Innovation Canada about what a social R&D process would be. You can read the report. I am going to talk about ecosystems, and the picture up there is a picture of the US agricultural ecosystem for research and development. There's lots to it, and we've been thinking about how you can unpack what needs to be in place for innovation not only to happen, but be sustained and to go to scale. So if we took a stock take of social R&D now in Australia, and lots of people have, and handily, the Community Services Industry Alliance and CSI produced a really interesting report just a couple of weeks ago. They looked at 92 Commonwealth reviews and reforms from Royal Commissions, Productivity Commission, etc., nearly over the last decades. And I'm just going to read you a quote here, Professor Gemma Carey. This is from Pro Bono. Whilst reviews were meant to address large-scale problems, it was clear that government or the community sector were not getting to the heart of fixing them. We all would have guessed it would have been some repetition, but we were shocked at the amount of repetition and the lack of movement, Carey says. It just means that really all we are doing is window dressing. So on the one side, we've got this ongoing cycle of fail, review, reform, repeat, and not much change. But on the other side, and this is the best thing about what we get to do at Taxi, is there's heaps of fascinating innovation happening out there at all sorts of different levels. But to some degree, everybody's struggling a bit in that they can't find the funding to take it to the next stage, or it's happening at the margins or in small, isolated ways. And maybe this is something a richer, a more mature social research and development ecosystem could address. Now, that's a question we've been asking with partners over the last few years, really, to try and get our heads around what might be a social research and development ecosystem. What have we got? What could we add to it? What should we focus it on? Love, Carolyn's going to tell you we should focus it on love. So we did a bit of an analysis of some of the reoccurring patterns and the elements in the social R&D system, and these are them. So first of all, this stuff around workforce. You need to train people to do this stuff. You need a talent pipeline. You also need people who want to do this work. If you think about the popularity of things like games designer to children and young people as an aspirational career, I really wonder how many young people aspire to being education reformers or health reformers or to reinvent prisons and justice. Some do, but perhaps not enough. There's the innovation piece. We've been talking a lot about that. Jeff and Christian last night were talking about the importance of idea and imagination, but that's not enough. We also need experimentation that builds evidence. We also need implementation, ways to take this innovation to scale, to distribute it. You know, that's something that the pharmaceutical industry has proven that it can do very quickly with the COVID vaccines, for instance. You need coordination, like the egg people, who, to quote them, this is their pun, not them, expertly coordinates innovation, it's true, across the egg ecosystem in Australia. And this is particularly important when it comes to social problem solving. And you need incentives. And one of those is paying customers. People have got to want to buy or pay for or fund things that are better. That's not always the case in the social R&D ecosystem. So I'm going to give you a chance to play with these shortly, but we've been looking at what are some of the reoccurring patterns, the practical things that you can take on board, adopt, do in your work to put R&D into place. And some of you will be thinking, this is a really terrible idea, and to some extent, I agree with you. There's actually lots of very good reasons why we should not take a commercial approach to R&D into social problem solving, because social challenges are quite different. By and large, commercial R&D, most mainly scientific R&D research processes, are not designed for the kind of complex problems that we deal with in the social space, where you can't say if something's solved or not. R&D is very good in its current design at meeting the needs of paying customers, which might be government in this case, but not necessarily the needs of beneficiaries, people who would benefit. You can make a strong case that it could lead to unethical experimentation on people. You could take a bit of a nihilistic view and say, well, actually, in politics, ideology trumps evidence anyway, so what's the point? R&D systems have a great history of creating futures people don't want to be part of. I don't know if any of you have seen that Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, where you see former engineers from Silicon Valley talking about how the algorithms that they designed have, they believe, a direct connection with young people and ideation around suicide because of how social media shifts people, percepts people's self-perception. You can also look at the impact of vast investment of social R&D into social media, R&D into social media, and the effect that's had on our democracy. Not intentional outcomes, but not good ones either. And R&D would also be another great way to reinforce, of course, white dominant culture over indigenous peoples. We're actually pro the idea of social R&D, but we think there's something you need to add to commercial scientific systems, and this is this idea of people power. How do you really put people at the center of decision making for this so that when you're creating futures, they're futures that people want to be part of? When you're designing things for people, that you get their input and intelligence into what would work. And there's a whole bunch of practical patterns that you can take a look at shortly to do that. But they're largely participatory, they're largely deliberative, drawing on things like deliberative democracy, but making that central to our public R&D systems. So what would be a really good ecosystem? Well, it would be one that accelerates the development of a future the public wants, and you can take these a bit of a set of principles, a checklist if you like. It would put people experiencing marginalization at the center of decisions, big and small. It would cultivate all of those things Jeff was talking about. It would build talent and capability, it would embrace diversity. It would generate interest, but also cultural esteem for social purpose innovation so that more people wanted to be health reformers or education reformers. And it would further Indigenous self-determination, Indigenous innovators, and also Indigenous knowledge systems. So let's imagine what they could look like. I'm just gonna give you a couple of case studies. And actually, this is you don't have to imagine too hard here because it's all written down. I don't know if anybody's seen the recent Future Skills Victoria independent review. We were involved at the peripheries of this, but it's very exciting for us because it proposes a review for post-secondary education in Victoria that really builds in research and development practices, a number of labs that will look at new learning experiences, and those learning experiences themselves are around things like the clean tech economy in Victoria and the care economy in Victoria. So it's something that's doubling down on innovation and learning, and that's a major reform or proposed reform that's building that in, which is a great time, I think, to build in this sort of thinking and practice. A lot of our work is in mental health, and there are amazing innovations out there, but they're not joined up or scaled up in the way that they could be. And we know the Productivity Commission found that $220 billion cost associated with mental ill health in Australia. If we made a 15% saving on that, that's equivalent to the national education budget. Could be worth doing. And there's people thinking about what that stuff could look like right now, not far from here in Brisbane South. They're working with people with lived experience of mental health to design new services and commission those, and people with lived experience of mental health holding providers to account as to what the design of those services would be. In South Australia, the Faye Fuller Foundation is funding 10 rural regional towns to design ways to regain control of their own mental health. They funded them for a year to come up with a plan. They're funding them for 9 more years each to really lead that. This is not service collaborations. This is actual real citizens leading this change. We've worked with the South Sudanese community in Greater Melbourne, who's invented some great and online ways to discuss mental health and trauma and racism in their communities. There's great stuff happening around the peer workforce. Governments are doing really interesting things around centers of excellence. We could join all this stuff up, and it could lead to a different kind of future. Just ask you to reflect on your own death for a moment. If I give you a choice for choosing to die at hospital or die at home or die somewhere else, who would choose die at home? Who would choose die in a hospital? Who would choose somewhere else? Okay, most people in Australia die in hospital. The kind of future that we, or bits of the future of aging and dying in Australia, aren't the kind of future I think anybody really wants to engage with. And it could be really different. And we're about to see the Aging Royal Aged Care Royal Commission report and recommend reforms to the aged care system. But we've been missing something, and of course there, this reform is needed and needs to happen, but we'd be missing something if we didn't also engage in a national conversation and bigger, more ambitious, more imaginative reforms about what actually is the Australia, the experience of ageing and dying in Australia that we want. And we could build the R&D systems that could get us there. We think this could be worth giving a go. We think that really embracing social R&D as a concept and building those institutions and systems actually could do a number of things. It could enhance the productivity, the effectiveness of actually some of the largest industries in Australia, those being health, education, care. It could also activate new resources to bring to those industries or to those challenges. Carolyn will talk a little bit more about that, but the way Virtual Village was activating people to help other people who hadn't been before, that sort of concept of engagement that Jeff was talking about. I think there's a solid money reason for doing this. We're talking about some big numbers when it comes to the costs of some of these social challenges. This could offer a way beyond that fail, reform, repeat cycle that we find ourselves in and CSI and CSIA documented so well. I think there's something in here, picking up from this morning's session, and I think it was Glyn that mentioned this, but creating institutions that can actually provide long-term stewardship over intergenerational challenges, things like mental health, and climate change, for instance, are much longer in terms of government cycles, electoral cycles. They're certainly much, much longer than machinery of government changes. We might need a different kind of stewardship if we're to make meaningful progress on these. Could create the future that we all want to live in and die in, and it could help our social systems be even more adaptive and responsive to in the volatile times that we're living in.
Through this course, we've learned about many of the dynamics that create a challenge to social innovation. The focus on financial returns over well-being and social returns, and the absence of any idea of planetary health or well-being from the accounts. The tendency to think and act reductively, to talk about complex problems as if they were simple problems that had a single cause or a single solution, that A plus B equals C thinking. People's general resistance to learn through doing, and the innate desire to be right about a solution, to know the answer, and people's general discomfort with uncertainty. And of course, the resistance of those with power to give up that power and control to the people who have the insights and the interest to actually solve the challenges and the problems we face. And in Australia, the most significant part of this power shift is the shift to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander self-determination. These things can show up in all sorts of innocuous ways. It might be a look of disbelief in the face of a colleague, or a delay in signing the paperwork you need signed to do the work you want to do, or a rule or a regulation that stops you doing what you want to do, or a general feeling that you're in this innovation work on your own, a feeling of loneliness. We hear that quite a lot. But I think the thing to hang on to is that social innovation is possible today. Even in these non-ideal conditions, many people are doing it, and they continue to break the ground, as many have done before them, to build the awareness, the interest, and the readiness for social innovation. So how do you work through this at a practical level? For example, if you're somebody who's got the job of running a social innovation project within government or in not-for-profit. Well, any social innovation project is going to need a sort of system of conditions around it. It's going to need an authorising environment to do the work. It's going to need relationships, for example, with people with lived experience or people with specialist technical support or people that have done this already. It's going to need some helpful policies or at least not unhelpful policies. It's going to need a project design, a process, and a team design that fits the budgets, the capabilities, the time, the money, the ambition, and the organizational context. And it's going to need people with the right qualities, mindsets, capabilities, who have an ongoing approach to learning to lead the work and facilitate the work. So if you recognize that these perfect conditions are not in place, then we need to think about the combination of short-term workarounds and long-term condition building that we need to do to make social innovation work. And I think the thing to know about that is that's going to take as much work, sometimes more, than the innovation work itself. If you don't have an authorizing environment, you can work under the radar, as many do, or you can do everything you can to create it. If you don't have the relationships you need, you're going to need to allocate time and people and money to building them. Or maybe you can accelerate those relationships by partnering with an organization that already has them. If you don't have the policies or they're getting in the way, you're going to need to change them. And that could be accelerated by learning from organizations that already have them in place or have been through that change process. To create a project design that fits budget, capability, time, money, ambition, organizational readiness. Well, this one I think is really hard to do unless you've got some deep experience in social innovation. And so working out how you can get somebody to help you with that if you're new to it, I think it's perhaps the most important part. And if you don't have the right people, you can find them or work with a partner that does, or work to build capability in teams. And we, for example, work to build capability in full-time teams, in distributed teams that organizations can call on when they need them, as well as in volunteers. And I think the idea of volunteer innovation teams is perhaps an underexplored opportunity. It could be a really interesting skilled volunteering opportunity. Well, we know that it makes a really interesting skilled volunteering opportunity. So different organizations take different paths with this. Some organizations, we'll call them the battlers, really struggle through it, working around the conditions or even working under the radar when the authorizing environment's not there. And this is probably the reality for the majority of not-for-profit teams pursuing innovation. If it goes well, you can get good results that can garner further support. But it can be really lonely and energy-sapping pursuit nonetheless. And we've seen leaders and practitioners battling their way to do social innovation, get real value from being part of a network with others outside of their organization going through similar challenges for that emotional but also the practical support. Other organizations, we'll call them the boutique operators, seek to create a special set of conditions for a limited set of time, for a project or even a year, to get the money, the people and the special dispensation to work differently, for example, being able to engage with different HR rules. And this can be a great way to get started, but without clear value creation in that time, social innovation risks being a one-off event. So many innovation teams close after a year because they've not been able to demonstrate their value to the core organization. And another real risk is that the overheads of getting started, for example, how long it takes to build a team, can cut down on the time to do the work. By the time you have a team and all the policies are in place and all the authorizing environment is in place, your time's up. The organizations and the leaders that we see making the most progress in social innovation recognize that today, because of the sometimes downright inhospitable conditions, doing social innovation takes more than just doing innovation. Instead, they try to increase the scope of their work, so they do innovation whilst also creating the broader conditions for it in their organization and system. We'll call them the builders, because they grow the conditions for social innovation whilst also doing the innovation. The implications of working in this way is that leaders and managers of social innovation work not only need to understand what social innovation work is, but also employ some pretty sophisticated skills to build its legitimacy in an organization or system and increase buy-in. So this building work often includes building and maintaining a portfolio of projects rather than just one. And a portfolio gives you enough of a chance to demonstrate value as well as to learn how to do social innovation work well. Building often involves building an approach to social innovation and a way of talking about it that fits in your context. There are many different ways to do social innovation and many different languages and ways of talking about change and new and different and better things in different sectors and fields. So I think builders try and find the right language, the right way to talk about it, so it has real meaning and value inside of their context. Builders are often building organizational legitimacy and building the authorizing environment through storytelling and demonstrating the value of what they do. That might mean evaluation, or it might mean creating some really compelling videos or some showing some really compelling results on the bottom line. Many builders engage with building capability and awareness and interest across the organization. So not just in the team, but sort of stowing a sort of general, general interest in social innovation. So more people know what it is, so more people can talk about the work. And of course, building takes building and managing a team of innovators, which may well include lived experience roles and technical specialist roles and domain experts. And some of those people may be working part-time or full-time or sort of distributed across the team and on call.
The Australian Volunteers Program is passionate about innovation, which is why we have an innovation hub, a place where we can test our ideas and create connections that improve volunteering. Our Innovation Hub is guided by a 5-stage process that nurtures new ideas and grows them into whole new ways of working. Each innovation starts with a need and an idea. It could be a simple suggestion to strengthen the way we work, or a revolutionary theory that changes the future of volunteering. Each idea is assessed using our stage gate process, and only the most promising ideas progress to the next stage. This will be repeated throughout the life cycle to make sure we're focusing our efforts on the best possible innovations. At the discovery stage, we gather data, spark conversations, and explore and define our thinking. Insights can be gained that change the direction of the project or inspire whole new ideas. We then work with stakeholders to design small-scale experiments that test our thinking. It can take a few tries to get it right, with insights fed back into improving the design. When the design is ready to go, we run a prototype that takes these ideas into real-world environments. Depending on the results, the idea may be fully grown and rolled out across the program. Innovation is a constantly evolving process. And the most exciting thing about innovation is that there is always something new to explore together. To learn more about the Innovation Hub, visit innovation.australianvolunteers.com.
That's Nathan, who we trained as an innovation associate originally. He was part of the distributed innovation team created by the Australian Volunteer Program. But now he's a full-time staff member or in the Innovation Hub based out of the Philippines. So you may remember from the module about innovation and imagination the story of the Australian Volunteer Program team and their innovation hub, as it's now called. It was called an innovation fund. And they've always approached their work as builders. So they started with just 1.5 full-time people, a budget, but a very relatively wide scope. And over 2 years, their innovations have demonstrated real value to the organization. Because of the way they've worked, they've increased buy-in to the program. I think particularly through quite a sophisticated governance routine that exposed the funders of the program, the organizational leaders, and also the service delivery leaders in the work and the in-country directors, and built capability and interest across the organization. When they came to designing their fund, they were relatively new to formal processes for innovation, so they looked for specialists for help. And that's where we started working with them and ended up partnering them partnering with them for the long term. The early years included a whole number of workarounds. So, for example, when faced with the challenge of doing innovation across 26 countries with 1.5 FTE, Anna, the innovation manager, decided that we'd train a set of volunteers and staff members, like Nathan, to be innovation associates. They were trained to do particular kinds of research and prototyping, and that vastly increased the capacity and the efficiency of the innovation team. With 16 volunteers across 16 countries, we could do research and prototyping, in some cases overnight. We'd create a brief in Melbourne one day, and by the time we woke up, we'd have had research data back from participant interviews in Vietnam and Mongolia, for instance. The program itself was an unexpected beneficiary of COVID, which forced nearly all Australian overseas volunteers to return to Australia. So the program really had to rethink its purpose, or how it would achieve its purpose. And recently, an independent evaluation has found that the program, which had been working on alternative volunteering models, including remote volunteering models, volunteering via the internet, allowed the program to make their COVID pivot, so supporting the move to remote volunteering en masse. So now, because it's been able to demonstrate that value, the program in the forthcoming contract is really substantiated as an ongoing part of the Australian Volunteers Program. It's much more deeply integrated into the core activities of the program now. Its budget has increased. There's a team of 5 people, and it has a really big remit now to explore the future of international volunteering, which until this point has largely remained unchanged for the last 70 years or so. And so this includes exploring new decolonized models of volunteering, local-to-local volunteering, and increased focus on issues including racism and gender. And what might it be like to work at a not-for-profit organization in a system that had fully adopted social innovation? Well, let's zoom forward to 2035 and hear from my son, Frank, who's written a report about his placement with an NGO innovation team working in mental health. I'm part of a team of dedicated innovation practitioners. We focus on co-design in the mental health system, and about half of us have experience of being a consumer in the mental health system or lived experience of mental illness. Every Tuesday, the team is a regular team meeting. The first item on the agenda this week was a review of 5 new requests for innovation that were created by the statewide Lived Experience Commissioning Board. For the last 5 years now, they told me that there have been dedicated lines of funding for innovation, controlled by a majority Lived Experience Board of Commissioners, informed by research on community needs. The second item on the agenda this week was a review of the portfolio of innovation projects. The team I'm placed with both works in improving some of the foundational supports for mental health, as well as exploring more radical new services that may become mainstream in the future. For example, we're working on improving the scripts of our telephone-based support services and exploring new kinds of suicide prevention based on artificial intelligence. Next week, 2 of our projects will go in front of our internal innovation pathway group. The group includes people with lived experience, service operations people, and the CEO, who decide what projects receive funding to advance, what repeats the stage, or gets stopped. There's some really clear expectations of the kind of evidence we present to the innovation pathway group, and we may not be there yet. It looks like we will have to repeat a phase of work. They call it recycling. The third item on agenda is about exploring a learning exchange with an Aboriginal-led co-design organisation. We wanted to know how to make our work more culturally appropriate, and the Aboriginal organisation is learning more about our trauma-informed approaches to co-design. We met because we're both part of a national co-design in social services learning network. We regularly swap methods and sometimes staff to learn from each other. The final item on the agenda is a big piece of good news. A new community first responder service has received a positive evaluation. That means it ranks more effective than the alternatives. So this means that over time, funding is guaranteed to flow to the model, and it will displace the existing models out there. Of course, the model itself is open sourced, so people are free to take it and improve on it. Since 2025 now, we've had a global open exchange of mental health models. Next, we're going to dive into the inner world of social innovation practitioners and social innovation leaders. And to do that, we're going to need one. And here's Carla Clarence. And here we go. Let's see what's in Carla's inner world. So here we are at the outer reaches of Carla's mind. And what a beautiful mind it is, and that continual buzzing and zapping you can hear is the sound of new neurons developing and new pathways being built. I guess one of the distinguishing features of the social innovator's brain is that it's continually evolving as through practice and reflection and ongoing learning, the brain is exposed to new ideas, to different disciplines and different ways of seeing the world. And we can start to see some of the main capabilities of the social innovator. And I'm happy to see here that everything Carla studied last year in Finzi is right here, doing, seeing, and thinking and acting systemically. Over here, we can see module on imagination and experimentation. Over here, capabilities in participatory ways of working and building the capabilities of others. And here, a whole section on first, nation first. So these are all capabilities that you can build in people, but there's something else too, and if we go deeper, we might just be able to see it. We're at the core now, and here you can see something that's much deeper and more intrinsic than any methods or processes, and it's much harder to build things at this level. So what you can see here are three pairs of core qualities. This first pair at the top here is idealism, the idea that the world can and should be a better place and that we can achieve greater equity. But this sort of wild idealism is grounded below here by a base of pragmatism. So together they create this sort of pragmatic idealism tension that allows people to act towards high ambitions whilst recognizing the limitations of the present. So sometimes in people you can see a really well-developed idealism, but that overpowers this pragmatism. So people never really, they want to do things perfectly, but they're not really able to act to do it. With an overdeveloped pragmatism, people are much more locked in the current. They're not necessarily striving for something different. So it's important these two regions are in balance. Let's shift our focus to the second pairing. And the second pairing you can see here running on the diagonal is, I call it the human complexity tension. On one side is a love for people and a belief in their potential. And look, this is so strong in Carla. And then on the other is the delight of working in complexity and with all of the forces at play. Innovators with an overdeveloped people, sometimes called the love region, can focus too much on individuals and at the local level and risk not acting systemically. Whereas innovators with an overdeveloped complexity and delight in working in all of this complexity can risk acting without humanity and in too technical a way, or getting lost in all of that complexity and mistaking that for the work. But when these two are in balance, as they are, you can see here, that holds the social innovator on track. And let's turn our focus now to the third pairing running across the other diagonal, is the drive-humility pairing. innovators with an overdeveloped drive and an underdeveloped humility are prone to ego, of prone to believing they're right and convincing and forcing their view on others. On the other hand, it's also common to see too much humility and not enough drive, leaving people too humble to act. And that drive and doggedness is important because you offer the best part acting against the status quo. Rules and policies are going to get in your way. Power structures will make it hard to do something different. And people, even friends and colleagues, might doubt you can achieve what you say you are going to do.
And I've often found too in those situations, if I was genuine, like if my gut really...
Thanks for having us drop by, Carla.
Quite forthright in that, at all costs, if I felt someone was at significant risk. So, but I think in the moment, it's just about being with them.
And if we did mainstream social innovation, what might life be like in 2040? Well, let's ask my son Ivor, who seems to have got himself his own radio show. G'day, this is 3D Radio, and I'm Ivor Steele Van Stone on Ghana Yurta in the year 2040. On the Youth Show today, we're reviewing 10 years of social progress in South Australia as part of the 20th year of the Festival of Life here from the Ghana Knowledge Lab in the Botanical Gardens, which for the last 30 years has been bringing 60,000 years of knowledge into the mainstream. New ways of living, new ways of doing. So the last 20 years since what some people call the Great Transformation, and, you know, people like me who were literally born in the middle of it don't remember it, but apparently we've seen real progress on reversing carbon emissions, on developing infrastructure for innovation, and in South Australia has become a real specialist in developing new kinds of mental health supports and new kinds of mentally healthy culture. This time last year, I got selected to be a representative of the Mental Health R&D Committee, and, well, something my brother always wanted to do. He was jealous I got it. And it's been a year of learning and choosing where to direct investments, and a real honour and a privilege to do that. And I was surprised to learn that they only really started that 10 years ago. Such a regular feature, and before that, long-term planning was done by people in government who just worked on four-year cycles. Wild when you think about how people used to do things back in the day. So later on in the show, I'll be talking to the founder of Wikiservice. If you don't know what that is, it's an open source website that documents all of the models around the world. And South Australia is a big contributor to it in mental health and people-powered solutions in particular. Yeah, and believe it or not, before Wikiservice was founded, people were just making up their own programs all of the time. Can you imagine that? They must have had a whole bunch of time on their hands. I guess it's like the time when people had to build their own home computers. Thankfully, things have moved on. I'll also be talking to Jack from the Indigenous Knowledge Lab here, and they've been working on creating a number of AI-based innovations based on traditional Ghana knowledge that are helping folks facilitate regenerative conversations in communities. And I was chatting to them earlier, and they were saying just how much of a kick it was to see people from Sweden downloading the program and putting it into practice. Such a connected world we're living in today, hey? And if you felt like coming over to the festival today, what might you find? Well, over in the learning field, you can access all of the learning resources and courses that are available. And there's also a bit of an exhibition of all of the different kinds of social innovation jobs available in South Australia today. In the community field, you connect with a growing number of community-controlled communities. Later on, I'm going to be scooting over to my favourite field, the complexity games and simulations, where you can watch the social innovation games. Teams from the schools and the professional teams battling out in holographic 3D today. Over in the kids' field, they can interact with children around the world with simultaneous translation. Why don't they make this stuff just for kids? And if you head over tonight, there's the Social Innovation Team of the Year is being announced, hot competition for that this year, and just some great work showcased. I was just looking into that on online earlier. And of course, we'll be announcing the research and development allocations for this next year. There are going to be some real surprises, not that I can tell you anything about it right now, of course. All right, let's go over to Tracy Neuradler and let's hear about what they've been doing in regeneration this year. It may be true that many of the conditions for social innovation are not in place today, but there's a way to view the world that suggests there are broader changes in society, or changes that we're on the verge of, that together will create a richer space for social innovation. They include demographic changes that suggest a shift to more progressive politics, with a greater social awareness amongst younger groups like Ivor's and Frank's generation, and a greater engagement with issues like climate change and movements like Black Lives Matter and reconciliation with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. On the other hand, when it comes to issues like climate change, it seems that things in Australia are getting so clearly bad and concrete that people will be forced to act, and will force their governments to act. Of course, we're seeing increased level of connectiveness and digital access around the world, increasing sophisticated use of digital platforms, but also I think an increased awareness of their shortcomings, and I like to think a willingness to fix them. So they start, you know, if they can be great at delivering us misinformation, maybe they can be tuned to delivering us truth. And I like to think there is some kind of digital revolution still to come in the world of social outcomes. It's going to be something different from putting government forms online. It's going to be something that enables a more dynamic democracy, that enables richer conversations and more informed debate. Post-pandemic, there seems to be a renewed focus of on purpose in work, and realization of the role of government and the ability to make major shifts in our way of living relatively quickly and in the name and interest of collective well-being. And we are continuing to increase our literacy in innovation. You can see that in business and technology, but also in government and in social services. And yeah, this gives me a bit of hope. And hopefully this course can make a small contribution to that.